saw the other train coming. I realized it was going to be a wreck. I felt it. I heard it. That's all. There's something unusual about that.
The only thing unusual about it is there wasn't any wreck.
Nothing wrong with your mind. Your ego's a little bruised because for once you don't know all the answers, but there's nothing wrong with your mind.
I still don't know if there's been a train wreck or not. I gotta find out.
They're all such wonderful people. Everybody has my interests at heart. Everybody wants to take me to the cops.
For Teddy's sake and for the sake of your own safety, I'm afraid I must insist. You're in pretty deep now. The man's been killed.
There is a forgery there. I can find it.
You had a month. The police went watching the museum 24 hours a day. You might. If it's only destroyed before it's discovered. Destroyed completely.
You like that, wouldn't you?
You forget my whole career is at stake.
So is my life. You've got to get me in there tonight.
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Cue the appropriate music. No. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
And thank you, Michael H. Price, the author of a good many things, many of them good. It's nice to be visiting with you again. And we got a special show this time, Michael. We're going to be doing two films, first of all, on the podcast, kind of going over a couple of different pictures. Bound by the idea that they were both taken from Frederick Brown works. Actually, one was taken directly from a novel, more or less, and the other was taken from a short story that appeared in Street Smith's Detective Story magazine, and I think suggested is the term that they use in the credits, suggested by the story. Both the story and the novel, I should say, by Frederick Brown. And the reason we're doing this is because our friend Stephen Hafner and his Hafner Press is putting out two beautiful collections of Frederick Brown short stories and longer stories from the pulps in the Frederick Brown Mystery Library. And he has asked us to pass that word along, which we're happy to do. And we want to talk a little bit about those books as well. But really the reason that we're doing this is because of Frederick Brown and this new exhaustive two-volume set that Hafner Press is doing. Hafner Press at www.haffnerpress.com. 744 pages in both these volumes. So
amazing.
Plenty of Brown. Plenty of Frederick Brown. You're a Frederick Brown fan, aren't you?
I never get enough of Frederick Brown. I always go back to him. Many such authors out of the pulp scene I'll revisit time and again.
Right.
Brown is probably near the top of the list. I would say maybe even more so than Cornell Woolrich.
You know, he is... You just never know, I guess is the best way to say it, what you're going to get with a Frederick Brown story. You know, you're going to get, obviously, a competent story. But some of his stuff, I remember just jumping out at me from the pulps. You'd read, everything was very formulaic in the pulps, and you get to a Frederick Brown story, and it was just completely, working within the strictures of the genre and the confines of the genre, he managed to come up with some incredible stuff.
That's the big difference that sets Frederick Brown quite apart, is that he, unlike Cornell Woolrich, for example, Brown has a very vivid sense of humor.
Yes.
And he tells these wonderful shaggy dog stories that also pack a wallop.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely right. And there's plenty of those in these volumes, and we would like to recommend them. Also, I should say, I guess, that Stephen Hafner and Hafner Press should have these books available at the Windy City Pulp and Paperback Convention, or Pulp and Paper Convention, which is toward the end of the month of this month of April in Chicago. And I'm sure you can look at Windy City Pulp and Paper Con or Convention online and find out the particulars. But Stephen's going to be there, and I'll be up there as well. It's one of my favorite places to go every year. And I'm going to really look forward to visiting with Stephen about these volumes. And we want to go ahead. Let's just jump right into the movies, Michael. The first is the one suggested by a Frederick Brown short story, which is called Madman's Holiday, and it was in a 1943 issue of Street and Smith's Detective Story. Now, Crack Up obviously has been used before. You know, I was thinking about the great Fitzgerald piece from, gosh, what would that be, but the mid-1930s, I suppose.
Right.
When it ran in Esquire, when it was essentially, not essentially, it was a nonfiction piece about the pressures on an author that led to his particular crack up. And then there was that Peter Lorre picture that he did for, what, for RKO, but did it for Fox, where he's the spy trying to get the plane from, and Brian Donlevy is the test pilot. That's a crack up. Well, 10 years later, crack up, that first crack up's 36. 10 years later comes this crack up from RKO. Had you seen this picture before?
Yes, but not since, oh gosh, it was before the RKOs started reappearing on the Turner Classic Network.
Mm-hmm.
So it would have been in late night syndication. A picture to relish and relish again and again, plays a lot like, and there is of course a Woolrich similarity.
Yes, there is.
In the Nightmare, mm-hmm. the Woolrich film from 1956, which also hinges upon an artistic soul driven to a crack up.
Right. And, you know, it's not, I imagine moviegoers of the time were not accustomed to seeing that artistic soul being Pat O'Brien.
Oh, no. He's very, Hollywood's depiction of the artist generally leans toward the effete ivory tower type.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You rarely see the accurate depiction of an artist as a working artist.
Right.
Shirt sleeves type.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Mitchum in The Locket comes to mind.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Certainly Pat O'Brien in Crack Up. The basis of his character is that he's no art snob. He attempts to demystify art for a mass audience.
Mm-hmm.
So So you get the contrast, and very realistically researched and deployed, you get the contrast between the shirt sleeves appreciator of art and the Manhattan art snob circle.
You do, and it's very well put together in the picture, and very well illustrated in the picture, I think. And it really got some like art museum like inside material in this picture.
Yeah.
And what you have is Pat O'Brien, who plays an art critic, as you say, who's trying to perhaps demystify art. There is a Gainsborough painting that is actually the focal point in many ways of the picture.
Mm-hmm. And he pays a lot of attention to that canvas.
He does pay a lot of attention to the canvas. And then you have one of these things in the Woolrich part that comes in. You have one of these things where he allegedly is in a horrible situation, in this case a train wreck, and then it turns out perhaps he wasn't in the train wreck at all. And that, of course, is very noirish as well. But I love the cast in this. Pat O'Brien is certainly playing against type, and I think he does a great job. Claire Trevor's wonderful, as usual. Ray Collins, who most people will know as Lieutenant Tragg in the Perry Mason series. Right. And one of my all-time favorites, Wallace Ford.
Good old Wally Ford,
oh,
yeah.
Golly, he could do anything, couldn't he?
He was a great leading man, of course, himself in those pre-noir films of the 30s.
Sure.
Also played, in many ways, Wally Ford had invented during the 1930s the wisecracking but resourceful and very vulnerable hero in some nice crime melodramas.
Kind of a Lee Tracy type, right? I mean,
it's kind of a Lee
Tracy. What Lee
Tracy
was doing with newspaper guys, yeah.
Yeah, and you get that wonderful Ford, that snappy patter.
Right, right.
Out of Ford, you get excellent work from Ray Collins as the doctor.
Mm-hmm. And you've got some stereo, you've got some almost caricatures too. And with all of these rich characters, you also have some caricatures along the way.
Mm-hmm,
it seems
mm-hmm,
to me
mm-hmm.
that come in and out of the picture. It's an interesting synthesis. I was studying a little bit about the director, and I don't know. Do you say his name Rice or Reese? R E I S.
Rice.
It's Rice, Irving Rice. And
yes.
What our listeners, or what I anyway, would know him for mostly was the Falcon pictures. He did, three of the Falcon pictures for RKO,
mm-hmm.
which
yep.
leads me to wonder if this would have been considered a B-picture at the time in 46.
Well, yeah, right up there with such RKO. RKO pretended to prefer its top-of-the-line pictures, but it was the Bs that made the money, and they not only put good, solid production resources into their B-unit pictures, but they also made a hell of a lot more money off the Bs.
Kind of like Universal,
and,
right?
Yes, and
mm-hmm.
they furthermore allowed the B producers and directors a great deal more creative latitude because they had less to lose.
That makes sense, yeah. And so you have some interesting stuff done with deep focus camera work. I noticed in this
mm-hmm.
that might not have been in a bigger picture. Might have been dissuaded, I guess. A big picture might have been dissuaded from taking this sort of experimental looking shots of the and. You know, and a bigger director probably the same way. It would have been in a curious way. I guess the A pictures were more predictable than the B pictures.
Definitely so. And if it weren't for the Bs, that is the B unit pictures from the larger studios and a few small studios, there would have been no French New Wave.
Right, right.
The Will Eisner masterpiece, The Spirit comic book, would have been much different because there was an influence on Eisner.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, if you get a chance to see an RKOB, I don't care what it is, a formal series or a standalone picture, don't pass it up.
Well,
because
yeah.
it's like, yeah, The Devil Thumbs a Ride comes to mind.
Mm-hmm. Falcon in Hollywood for me.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the bigger Bs, like Out of the Past.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I have preferences among the Bs from every studio that made them, but it seems like, it's like going back to Frederick Brown. I usually gravitate back to RKO.
Right, right. Well, was Pat O'Brien then, this was the down part of the bell curve, the other side of the bell curve on his career, right? He was in his 40s, I think, when he made this picture.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so he was still kind of on the downhill run.
It was that necessary transition from leading man to a very long-lived and popularly beloved character actor.
We don't want to give anything away, Michael, but there is a... To me, there is, and we haven't talked about this, but I'm interested to know what you think. There's definitely, Joey and I have talked about it, there's definitely a Manchurian Candidate vibe in this.
Well, yeah. What has happened to this guy, we
right.
really don't know.
During wartime.
Yes, mm-hmm. the crack up suggests, the term today would be PTSD.
Right.
Mm-hmm. exacerbated by the runaway train situation at the start of the film.
Mm-hmm.
The guy is shell shocked.
Yes, that's the old term for PTSD, of course. Yeah,
right.
And he is also, since he's our protagonist, I mean, you talk about Woolrich. It's interesting you should mention that, because there are some Woolrichian qualities in that, including the flashback, the use of flashback, a guy.
The use of flashbacks. I mean, you come in on this picture after two reels, you're doomed to be flabbergasted.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. And the print that Joey and I saw was an old CNC television print, and it was about the first, 20 minutes, Joey, or something, we were threatening to lose the picture and lose the sound and everything, and then it would come back. And maybe that's exactly the right way to watch it. I don't know. But, you know, it's a dreamlike picture. It has that great dreamlike quality that that a lot of the films noir have, but it's still anchored in that really interesting reality, and especially that art museum thing. It's kind of it's a sort of a classy picture. I mean, even though it's the art museum, and then they sort of correspond that with a really strange scene in a penny arcade.
Yeah, the contrast of low art and high art.
Exactly, exactly.
And the argument that art must be democratized for the masses, if it's to have any relevance at all. Otherwise, you're just preaching to the converted,
right.
And that would be the art snob group. The penny arcade, you know, it's like we've often said, there is only one art, and I don't care if you're talking about the fine museums or the cheap thrills of the arcade. Or commercial fine. There's only one art. The beauty of O'Brien's character is that he does that act of democratizing fine art so the average Joe can get it.
Mm-hmm. I think that anybody who's ever taught English or literature at a high school or college level would understand that immediately, that whole idea. And they would understand, of course, the one of the characters in the pictures, and I can't remember the actor's name who plays the artist who challenges Pat O'Brien during one of his lectures.
Oh yeah,
to the people, and it's very. I mean, the battle lines are drawn there, and they were drawn then, and they've probably been drawn for centuries and longer than that over democratization of art versus keeping it for yourself, and that's probably something that's going to be argued long after we're gone, but it's pictured pretty well in this movie. And
very important.
Yeah, it is important, and I think Pat O'Brien does a fine job in it. And I'm sure you'd recommend the picture. I would too. I think it's fairly easy to find, is it not? Where did you find it?
I found it on the Turner Network, Classic Movies.
Good.
Which incidentally has started doing a new film noir showcase every Sunday.
Nice. Well, you know, here in Claremore, Oklahoma, at RSC TV, or RSU TV, I should say, Rogers State University, I'm privileged to be able to do a little series called Film Noir Theater. And we do the same thing weekly. So if anybody's within or has RSU TV on their cable systems, which is pretty much all of northeastern Oklahoma, if you happen to be around there, I'd invite you to give that a look too. But we're not here to plug me, Michael. We're here to talk about Frederick Brown in celebration, really, of the two new books of Frederick Brown stories out from Hafner Press.
You know, 700 odd pages on that first volume, and I'm just breezing through it.
Oh, it's wonderful.
It's really a lot. One thing that hadn't occurred to me until now is that reading Frederick Brown is a lot like reading my old pal Joe Lansdale.
How so?
Same conversational sensibility, same sense of humor amid some really grim circumstances, and the use of the vernacular as opposed to a formal, properly spoken style.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he makes you feel like he's talking to you. That's the beauty of Brown.
Well, he's got that really, he learned how to write for the pulps, and you couldn't mm-hmm. be too highfalutin and build any sort of a wall between yourself and the readers with the pulps. And so he learned that lesson, then he learned how to take the reader with that conversational tone and go down some pretty strange paths.
Well, if not for the conversational tone, some of his concepts might be just too darn weird.
Boy, no kidding. Well, the two books are called Murder Draws a Crowd, the Frederick Brown Mystery Library Volume 1, and Death in the Dark, the Frederick Brown Mystery Library Volume 2, both available from Hafner Press at www.hafnerpress.com. And we want to thank our friend, Stephen Hafner, for making the books available to us so we could look them over. And as a matter of fact, next month, we think we are going to have these two volumes and be able to give away a set of these volumes, which is $100 value, as they say. We're starting to sound like the Shopping Network now, but we're going to give away a set of those next month's podcast.
Just like that other dame.
Looks after her, you'd think a bosom was something unique.
Ripper versus stripper. Now a shiver of anticipation runs through you. Now a quiver of fear. Over 5 million read the novel about the striptease murders. Now see it come stabbingly alive on the screen.
If somebody wanted to take a crack at her, like throwing a knife maybe, when would be his best chance?
End of the number, she lays there all curled up. The lights are dim, she's not moving. Makes a mighty pretty target.
So, meanwhile, we've got another picture to look at, and this is a fascinating movie in a lot of ways. It's based on, I think, one of Frederick Brown's best novels. And I will say right now, let me go on record as saying this is a fine movie for what it is, but it's not as good as the book, I don't think.
I think the book is induplicable except as a reading experience.
That's probably true because of the way that it can be told, the story can be told, right?
Well, it's really probably Columbia's best B picture of the period.
And they kind of played it off. I think they sent it out with a fairly obscure picture as a double feature. I don't know if it made any money or not, but it's an awfully interesting movie, if nothing else. And, you know, Anita Ekberg, we think of her, and we're talking about Screaming Mimi. The name of the movie, Screaming Mimi from 1958, and directed by Gerd Oswald. Now, German, of course, mostly a TV director. He even did a couple of Star Treks, did some Outer Limits. But the thing that I remember him doing the most, Oswald, is Agent for Harm. Do you remember for Harm?
Definitely Agent for Harm, yes.
From 66, just goofy, right in the middle, well, actually toward the end of the secret agent craze. And Mark Richman as a character named Adam Chance. Now, you might not know Mark Richman's name, but I'll guarantee if you saw a picture of him, you know exactly who he was. He was a hugely prolific actor. He started in 49 in movies and acted through 1988. And in the 70s, even after the 70s, when he became an Episcopal priest. Mm-hmm. And the idea of Episcopal priest and this Adam Chase character, Adam Chance, I should say, is a little bit hard to connect the dots with. But that was Gerd Oswald's, the film that I remember Gerd Oswald, I remember the most of Gerd Oswald's was Agent for Harm. Now, this one is not that kind of a romp at all. This is a pretty dark picture in a lot of ways.
Pretty dark picture, and of course it presages the German filmmaking movement called Krimi.
Yes, can you tell us a little more about that?
The Krimi pictures from Germany came into fruition more in the 1960s, although the style and attitude had persisted in German film since the 1920s.
Right.
That dark Gothic expressionism, Screaming Mimi. American-made German director has very much that same Germanic expressionism attitude to it. The use of symbolism, as in the title object of the film itself, mm-hmm. the Screaming mm-hmm. Mimi. How do you describe this film? Well, I've always likened it to a Columbia top-of-the-line picture, which I still think of as a B, called Suddenly Last Summer,
mm-hmm.
from about the same period.
Tennessee Williams, the adaptation of the Tennessee Williams play, sure.
Right, mm-hmm. yes. Screaming Mimi has Anita Ekberg in the...
Liz Taylor role?
In what would be the Liz Taylor role. And... And the circle of physicians, the desperate mental collapse situation that both actresses have in common in the respective films,
mm-hmm.
and it's like how come Screaming Mimi doesn't get as much respect as Suddenly Last Summer, because they both typify the Columbia B attitude.
Wait, how would you sum that up? That attitude.
A lot of sense of now, as opposed. Well, I'm not counting the Boston Blackie pictures,
sure.
which are based on a sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly the Columbia Bees that
like
stand
the
alone,
Whistler,
like,
for instance, or the
individual entries in the Whistler series.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, a picture called So Dark the Night.
Oh yes,
with mm-hmm. Stephen Giray. The typical Columbia B that there's a sense of foredoom. It's like this is not going to turn out well for anybody. and yet it's not a nihilistic or punishing picture.
Right.
The classic Columbia B has that attitude that's like, we're going to take you into some really dark places, and we might even do you harm.
Mm-hmm.
But you're going to be so enchanted with this picture that you're going to stick with it.
Well, that describes Screaming Mimi pretty well, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. And it's like, and of course, there's the overriding element of jazz.
Yes, and especially, I'm glad you brought that up, because I was so happy to see Red Norvo, one of my favorite vibraphonists, in there, and actually had a dramatic, he had a dramatic role in that.
Oh, yeah, it's you see that occasionally. Band leaders like Billy May, Shorty mm-hmm. Rogers would play prominent figures in some of the film noir pictures of the 1950s. Norvo, boy, what a personality. I mean, he radiates.
You know, I'm so surprised he didn't do other movies, because he's really a commanding presence in Screaming Mimi.
No, he's as good a dramatic presence as, oh, looking to a different genre, as for example, Chuck Berry is in Go Johnny Go.
Right. Who didn't parlay that in any other appearances really either, right?
Right, and mm-hmm. it's like, okay, these guys in their respective pictures are very well-spoken, dynamic presences, and they take supporting roles in the two pictures
mm-hmm.
and turn them into like regular scene stealers.
Well, you know, this film, Screaming Mimi, made me think about the thing I go to again and again, that Andre Gide quote, art is born of constraint and dies of freedom.
Yeah.
They couldn't show what really went on in the club where Anita Ekberg's character was dancing. They couldn't show striptease or at least topless dancing or whatever. So they come up with this bizarre thing with her hands tied and like it has echoes of sacrificial altars and I don't know what all, and make it a lot stranger than if they just show nudity. It's just a lot weirder, you know? It's amazing. And Gypsy Rose Lee being in it also lends it a little bit of weirdness, too.
Well, the Legion of Decency was all over Hollywood.
In 58, they still had a pretty good hold on it, didn't they?
Still had a pretty good chokehold, and they kept finding, well, you can't show that, you can't say that, you're forbidden to blah, blah, blah. The upshot of that was not the repressed filmmaking machinery that the Legion of Decency desired, but rather a pretty subversive system of getting around the censors.
That's right, and almost winking at the audience that was hip enough or interested enough to get it. You know, it was a lot what they came up with, and again, you look at that. I don't know, and I don't want to sound like an old poop here, but I'm not sure that TV has created better writers than wrote in the early days in the 50s when there was so much repression. TV was repressed more than the movies and created Rod Serling and Reginald Rose and Paddy Chayefsky and all those guys. And this is the same way with this. They're forced to come up kind of with a third way to do things. And in this picture, they really do a good job of it, I think.
Tremendous picture. I love to watch it again, forgetting all I can about previous screenings, just to see how the surprise plays out.
Well,
And then with that impression fresh in mind, watch it again and concentrate on how artfully you've been misled. Into expecting something that doesn't happen.
And I look also at how interesting some of the performances are. And I misspoke. I got two of my notes mixed up. I was talking about Mark Richman and Agent for Harm having such a long career. He did, but the guy I really was talking about there who had his career from 49 through 88 and indeed did become a priest in the Episcopal Church was Harry Towns. And Harry Towns is psychiatrist in Screaming Mimi, who becomes Mimi, or not Mimi, but who becomes Anita Ekberg's character's manager, and is, of course, completely smitten with Anita Ekberg with a lot of hints. There's hints all over the place in this film about relationships they couldn't come right out and say, including Gypsy Rose's relationship with her young protege, her young female protege, and also Harry Towns' character, his relationship with Anita Ekberg's character. There's a lot of unspoken in this.
There's a lot of ethical breaches among these characters.
Yes, there are.
And it's like, what? Okay, this just, the first response is, what are they thinking? And the second is just, bring it on.
That's right. And you know, you get, if nothing else, you get an idea of what's going to be shown you or where they're coming from with the names of those nightclubs on the row where Anita Ekberg is working. The Gay and Frisky, and that would be G-A-Y apostrophe N Frisky. The Gay and Frisky, and then I believe Gypsy Rose Lee, who's kind of a Texas Gwennon type in this picture, works at the L Madhouse. The L Madhouse.
L Madhouse, yes.
Perfect. That's absolutely perfect. And, you know, people don't really, I don't think, you hear Anita Ekberg, and of course you think about Fellini and stuff, but really, Anita Ekberg, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think she really became a star until La Dolce Vita in 60, right?
That was a long, dry spell, and she persisted.
And in 55, I have a picture of her in my vast collection of weirdness. I have a picture of her trying out for the Sheena Queen of the Jungle part that went to Irish McCullough in, what, 55, I guess.
Sure.
And Irish McCullough actually beat Anita Ekberg out, and I remember speaking with Irish McCullough a few times, and she was very proud of the fact that she had bested Anita Ekberg to become the Queen of the Jungle. But Anita Ekberg was showing up in the usual thing with a starlet, small roles in bigger pictures and bigger roles in smaller pictures. And that's what this was. Screaming Mimi was, I guess, a small picture.
Sure, yeah.
I wonder if this was her first starring role. Do you have any idea?
I would have to look, and I'll bet you. Well,
it's close. I'll bet. I bet she hadn't
when you
made
got
before
the cheat
then.
Sheet handy. When you got the cheat sheet.
Oh, you got the cheat sheet. All right, we'll take a look there and see what you can come up with.
Supporting roles, including some uncredited roles. Well, gosh, she was. Abbott and Costello Go to Mars.
Right. She was one of the Venusians in that, wasn't she?
Yes, yes, kind of like the ancestor of Queen of Outer Space.
Exactly.
The supporting roles in larger pictures, including Martin and Lewis, Artist and Models.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. She actually has a fairly good supporting role in that, as I recall, doesn't she? Mm-hmm. Is she playing the next door neighbor to Dean Martin's character in that?
Yeah, and it's a very promising thing. And it, of course, Artists and Models occurs what 3 years before Screaming Mimi.
Right, right. Well, now you talked about the German pictures that this was kind of a precursor for. I've seen also in researching, and believe it or not, folks, we really do research on these podcasts. I also keep running into things that indicate that it was a predecessor of the Giallo pictures, and that in fact Bird with a Crystal Plumage is in its way a remake of Screaming Mimi, although Frederick Brown's
in
not
credited. Many ways the same basis in Frederick Brown's novel. The German Krimis, the Italian Gialli.
Mm-hmm.
You look at Mario Bava, Dario Argento,
right,
and you see them, if not mimicking the attitude of Screaming Mimi, certainly channeling that in a great many of their pictures.
Mm-hmm.
The German made Edgar Wallace adaptation.
Yes, right, right.
Just amazing. It's like somebody once said, Anita Ekberg in Screaming Mimi looks as though Edwige Finesse would not be a match for her. And well, I think,
Well, there's those threads in the film, in this film, and I guess what it has in common, certainly with the Gialli, is the threads of obsession and the threads of madness that just run just stitch back and forth through this picture. I'm kind of a sucker for films when psychiatrists go crazy, or at least kind of go off the deep end a little bit. And Nightmare Alley being one of the films I love because of that, or because of the psychological, the people who allegedly know their psychological P's and Q's get thrown off by some sort of obsession, which is certainly what happens with Harry Towns' character in Screaming Mimi. And I really like that. That character is the most interesting character in the picture to me, because he gets progressively into a physician heal thyself state without giving away too much. We don't want to do that. But I think it's a very solid picture. It's not, again, I think probably it's like, perhaps I can make the comparison with the film version of Grapes of Wrath. Not that this has those sort of aspirations, but there are two pictures. One, picture that's an adaptation of a book that are in their own way both really good, but both totally different animals, too.
Oh, yeah. That's otherwise, why adapt?
Right, exactly. And we're talking about, we just finished talking about a couple of Frederick Brown pictures, or pictures based on Frederick Brown books, one book, one short story. And we're doing that because we are actually sponsored this on this podcast by Hafner Press, that just now, just as we're speaking, bringing out the two-volume Frederick Brown Mystery Library, Murder Draws a Crowd, the first one, Death in the Dark, the second one, both reprinting Frederick Brown stories from the golden age of the pulp magazines. And plus, in the first one, there's that appendix, which is really interesting. When Brown was working for the driller and excavating engineer, and was writing humor pieces, as you say, for that, and those are very, very interesting pieces as well.
Yeah, talk about your classic Shaggy Dog type story.
Yes, exactly, which, as you say, is what Frederick Brown excelled in. And so we want to once again mention Hafner Press's Murder Draws a Crowd and Death in the Dark, and you can find out more, including how to order them, of course, at www.hafnerpress.com, HAFFNERpress.com. We want to thank Stephen Hafner of Hafner Press for contacting us about this. And also, if you order the books or when you contact Hafner Press, let them know that the Forgotten Horrors podcast sent you. We'd appreciate that. And Michael, what have you been up to in your own work lately?
Oh, indexing away on the 11th volume of Forgotten Horrors.
Very good. Very good.
And that doesn't mean the series is complete. We've still got to go back and finish Volume 9. Volume 10's already in print. We just leapfrog on this.
Right, right.
And then a new set of restorations from the 1940s Ghost Gallery comic book series, which is rocking along. We've got a ways to go. I think Volume 2 will bring it maybe up to the halfway mark of the series, which ran from 1942 through 46. And then for the longer term, we've got some projects of our own connivance.
We do.
I'm just now putting the initial touches on a graphic novel, an anthology of comic stories called Deep in the Horrors of Texas.
Nice. Very nice.
The voting deadline, and anyone can vote for the Rondo Awards, that would be April 19. The ballot is at rondoaward.com. Mm-hmm. And it's nice to get a nomination. We're up for Volume 8 of the Forgotten Horrors series now.
We also want to mention Steve Vincent, and I hope it's Furness. I was talking to Joey before we went on, and it's Furness, and I was saying, well, I said, you know, it's like Betty Furness, and Joey looked at me like, you know, he was looking through me. It was like, gave me that old VA hospital stare. And I guess kids don't know Betty Furness, the pitch woman from back in the 50s. Was it GE that she was pitching, do you recall, Betty Furness?
Some line of
it was refrigerators and stuff, and it was Maytag or something. Anyway,
I always thought she should have been pitching furnaces.
She should have been pitching furnaces.
but she
wasn't. So Steve Vincent Furness actually did something we have asked listeners if they'd like to do. He sent us a picture of himself. I sent it to the Forgotten Horrors podcast
group. Facebook page.
Facebook page. A picture of him and you want to look at this, Michael. I think it's a very early version of Forgotten Horrors. Maybe the first.
That's the 1986 edition.
It's the 1986 edition. Okay, so you've seen it then. Okay, good. So if anybody wants to do that, it's great. We love to see you do that. And next time, if you want to hold up one that I had something to do with, that'd be fine too. But you don't have to. That's not necessary. But just take a, I guess, what do you kids call it? A selfie, Joey? Take a selfie with you. Or a loved one can take it for you. And post it to the We Have a Forgotten Horrors podcast Facebook page. And that's free. People just have to go to it and sign up, right? Okay. All right, good. And if you want to do that, and we want to thank Steve for doing that as well, and join us next week because we're going to, or next week, next next podcast, which will be next month, because we're going to be talking about another picture, to be determined, TBD, but we're definitely going to be giving away a set of these wonderful Frederick Brown collections that are coming your way from Hafner Press, Murder Draws a Crowd and Death in the Dark. So check those out. We want to thank Steve Hafner for his interest and for sponsoring this podcast. And Michael, I have to tell you, I started to tell you before we left, the with baseball season coming on, Ralph Terry, the Yankee pitcher whose story I was able to tell in Right Down the Middle, the book that's out now, is up in New York, even as we speak, getting ready to start a little book tour in conjunction with opening day at the New York Yankees, Yankee Stadium in the Bronx. And so that book is opening a lot of doors. We're getting reviewed. We've gotten reviewed in the Boston Globe and the New York Daily News and the New York Times. And it's a finalist for the Oklahoma Book Award. So we're just going to keep I'm a big baseball fan, and I suspect that some of our listeners are as well. So if you are, check out Right Down the Middle. It's the Ralph Terry story, the story of the only man who pitched the final pitch in two World Series Game 7s. And I have just told his story, so Ralph Terry's.
Mighty nice.
Well, we'll see you guys next time. Again, thank you, Michael. Thank you to Joy Hambrick, our producer. And thank you, Stephen Hafner of Hafner Press. And check out those Frederick Brown Mystery Library collections at www.hafnerpress.com. Michael, back at you soon.
Won't be long.
All right.